This is W.W. Chaplin. I'll be back in a moment with news of the world.
When Shakespeare wrote about music of the spheres, it was a figure of speech. Today, it's an actuality. Today, we hear music of the spheres. For with radio, music comes to us literally out of nowhere. And we know music of the hemispheres, for radio has taught us melodies from every corner of the globe. Amusement, information, and inspiration are constant travelers on the airwaves for the enjoyment of radio listeners. These benefits may be had in fullest measure when you dial to NBC. For NBC, the National Broadcasting Company, offers top entertainment, vital discussions, compelling drama. And of prime importance today, NBC and its independent affiliated stations give you the complete reliable news, the truly authoritative commentary. Keep tuned to NBC, and you'll keep abreast of the world. And now, here is W.W. Chaplin.
Apparently, the Japanese just don't get the idea. They have bowed to defeat, but only coldly and calculatingly, as you might bow on the street to a business acquaintance whom you don't like and are trying to outwit in a deal. They aren't acting like a defeated nation. They are giving no more than lip service to the Potsdam ultimatum, and they're delaying actual formal surrender with deliberate stalling. NBC's Merrill Muller in Manila has picked up this morning a report from the Tokyo radio saying their emissaries will be in Manila Sunday. That's their latest. The Japanese say that they can't possibly get all their forces to stop fighting in less than 12 days. But they send General MacArthur notes calling on him to tell the Russians to stop advancing and fighting when that's the only way they can advance. What they are apparently trying to do is to impose an armistice period between official acceptance of the Potsdam terms and the formal signature of unconditional surrender. An indefinite armistice period in which they can finagle for easier terms. Now, when a war is ended by unconditional surrender, there is no armistice, nor are there any negotiations to discuss terms. The terms are what we care to make them. This was made very clear to the Germans, and apparently it's going to have to be impressed on the Japanese. Perhaps the root of the trouble is in the different methods employed by the Allies in ending the two wars. In the war against the Germans, we didn't take their word for anything until the surrender documents were actually signed. We didn't announce to the world that the Dönitz government of Germany had surrendered until it really had surrendered, and the signed papers were handed to General Eisenhower. Then he and the Russians set the cease-firing time for 24 hours later, and immediately after that, we disarmed the Germans. There was no interim period then, as there is now, and we were very careful to avoid any use of the word armistice, though that was perhaps difficult, because that was the old way to do things, and we had the ending of the First War as a precedent. It was so hard to forget that form of peacemaking, in fact, that even General Eisenhower himself made a slip of the tongue right after the German surrender had been made, and had to be censored, even if he was the supreme commander. I can tell this story now, because at last all censorship has been lifted. I don't think it's ever been told before. I was in the French surrender city of Reims on that fateful night, and watched the unconditional surrender of Germany signed by General Jodl, the chief of the German General Staff, and by Admiral Friedeberg, the German Grand Admiral who later committed suicide. General Eisenhower was not present at that ceremony, because a supreme commander does not deal directly, personally, with the enemy. But he was in a nearby room, and as soon as the surrender was an accomplished fact, the German general and the German admiral were taken to him. They stood up there with hats in hand and made their verbal promise to see that the surrender terms were carried out. General Eisenhower then dismissed them abruptly, and then he went himself for the first time into the surrender chamber. Sitting at the surrender table, flanked by the highest American and British members of his staff, the supreme commander made a brief talk for the official newsreels. And in it, he was talking without script or even notes. In it, he expressed his pleasure that this armistice had been signed. Watching him, you could tell that he realized his mistake as soon as he'd made it. And it was a mistake, just a slip of the tongue. The Germans would have liked nothing better than the use of that term, armistice, so much milder than unconditional surrender by the supreme commander of the Western Allies. But, of course, the word armistice never appeared in the released form of that sound film. You may have seen the picture in the newsreels back here at home and heard the general make his talk, but the sentence containing the word armistice you didn't hear, because it had been neatly cut out by the censors, with, of course, General Eisenhower's full approval. The Germans didn't get any armistice. They moved directly from being at war to being a defeated and disarmed nation, completely under our orders. Now Japan is trying to do something Germany never had a chance to do. Because we announced Japan's acceptance of our ultimatum, her agreement to surrender, before the actual surrender was signed, because of that, she evidently saw a chance to delay and stall and put us off. She has tried to impose an armistice where there is no rightful place for one, and so at least save face in some devious oriental way. The Mikado has issued ceasefiring orders, but with such provisos of probable delay in their being carried out that right in Tokyo itself, his forces have not considered themselves bound to strict and immediate obedience, as they would if they thought that their god emperor really meant what he said. The latest incident showing their defiance of our authority occurred right over Tokyo Bay. Four of our big B-32 super bombers, an even later model than the B-29s, they were flying over the bay on a purely photographic mission, which under the circumstances they had every right to do. And suddenly they were jumped by 10 Jap fighter planes, which had no right to be in the air at all, certainly not armed and on aggression. We hadn't even sent any fighter escort with those big camera planes, but fortunately the B-32s did have their guns, and they were well manned. They shot down two of the Japs, and the rest retired, but only after one of our planes was badly shot up. That none of our men happened to have been injured is no thanks to the Japs. They tried to kill our men, both from their fighter planes and by anti-aircraft fire from the ground. We are not going to give any armistice, any more than we gave the Germans one, and General MacArthur is moving now towards speedy termination of this false armistice, which that incident over Tokyo Bay has shown might be very serious for us. MacArthur, who now holds the same position in the Pacific that Eisenhower did in Europe, has sent a curt note, which sounds certainly like an out-of-patience note to the Emperor. This note says, "The directive from this headquarters is clear and explicit and is to be complied with without further delay." Now, that's plain talk. It covers the Japanese ceasefiring dilly-dally, and it covers their stalling in failing to send peace emissaries to sign the surrender in Manila when they were told to. No matter whether they come Sunday or not, they still have delayed. And like all such orders, it carries an implied "or else." Just what General MacArthur's "or else" is, the Japs can only surmise. But they surely have not so quickly forgotten Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Another nudge for Hirohito comes from London, where a British Foreign Office spokesman said there is nothing to exclude the Emperor from being tried by the Allies as a war criminal if they decide that he was partly responsible for his country's policy of aggression. It seems to me that if the Emperor is as wise as he is wily, he will realize that the time has come for him to get on his white horse and get going. Over on this side of the world, we are still getting individual surrenders by little groups of holdout Germans. Just today, another German submarine, the U-977 with a crew of 32 men, surrendered to the Argentine authorities. Where that pig boat has been hiding for 3 months and more since the German surrender is an untold secret. Certainly it can't have been cruising underwater all this time. No submarine carries such a fuel supply. Someone has been giving it aid and comfort, though apparently the comfort was not enough to make bearable the prospect of indefinite hiding in outlawry. And now for a pleasanter subject than talking about our ex or almost ex enemies. Here are some more developments in what we're doing to assure jobs Jobs for our men who have been fighting those wars, overseas and on the many home fronts. A dispatch from Washington says that $5 billion of flood control and navigational projects await now only a congressional starting gun. Congress has already authorized the Army's Chief of Engineers office to do about $4 billion worth of work. And it also has okayed work by the Bureau of Reclamation that will total about another $1.33 billion. All that's needed now is specific appropriation by Congress of the money to pay for this work which it has already authorized. And here's an idea of what this means in the way of jobs. Real, honest-to-goodness jobs and not any made-work boondoggling business. The Army engineers say that $700 million worth of their work is in the ready-to-go category, and that much alone will give work to 200,000 men for a whole year. That seems to mean that their whole $4 billion worth of authorized projects would give a year's work to more than 1 million men. And add to that the Reclamation Bureau jobs, and you have a year's work for roughly 1.5 million men. That's not everything, of course, but it's an awful good start. It all depends on Congress, when it reconvenes, appropriating the money for these projects, which it has already approved. But that would seem to be a foregone conclusion. There's little news from Europe today. General de Gaulle has commuted to life imprisonment the treason death sentence imposed on Marshal Pétain. That, I think, will be generally approved in France. At the time the old marshal was brought back to France from Germany, I was in Paris, and it was plain to me that a great many Frenchmen felt that his past glories should be taken into full account in judging him now. And, after all, the sentences of death and life can't be very different in this case, as the marshal is already 84 years old. I'm sure that de Gaulle will not have weakened himself politically by tempering justice with mercy. Here at home, our government has taken steps to see that Americans have plenty of fun available during the undoubtedly trying transition period between war and peace. All bans on sports, both professional and amateur, were lifted today. Racehorses can be shipped once more. Teams can travel. The grandstand public can go to watch the games. But there's a caution, too, from ODT, the Office of Defense Transportation. Don't go hog wild on travel, it says, or there might be new restrictions. After all, we've got to get those men from overseas back to their homes. Another restriction has been lifted, an old American custom restored. It's all right from now on to hold state and county fairs, which for many communities used to be the year's principal social and business event. A little late for this year, perhaps, but I wonder what up-and-coming community will lead the parade. That's all for now, and thank you.
The world speaks a lot of languages. In fact, humans express themselves in nearly 3,000 different tongues. In that babel of sounds, there's only one sound, there is one sound, that's known the world over. It's the sound of the NBC chimes. Those three familiar notes that follow every National Broadcasting Company program are known everywhere, and they symbolize the world's greatest network known everywhere. The National Broadcasting Company is a network grown strong from the technical skills that created it. It is a network grown famous for the high quality of its programs. It's a network grown great for its devotion to the principle of true public service. The National Broadcasting Company, a free American institution, serves the entire world. And in the world of many tongues, the NBC chimes are familiar to all. W.W. Chaplin is heard each Monday through Friday at this same time, 1:45 to 2, over the network of the National Broadcasting Company.